KBOO Portland, going out to you via 90.7 FM and via KBOO.FF to all the ships at sea.
This is KBOO. Coming up next on Fight the Empire, Per Fagering interviews Mandy Smithberger, director of the Strauss Military Reform Project.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fagering, and we have a special guest today. Her name is Mandy Smithberger with the Center for Defense Information at the Project on Government Oversight. So, Mandy Smithberger, welcome to KBOO. Is she there?
I am.
Oh, okay. I hear you now. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is a topic that's been on my mind for a long time because, I keep hearing, I guess most recently, the Congress or Senate passed a Pentagon budget, and the figure I saw was, I think, $735 billion. But the numbers, right. You keep getting different numbers all the time, so why don't we try and unravel all that?
Let's do it.
So tell us a little bit about the Center for Defense Information first.
Absolutely. So the Center for Defense Information was founded by retired military officers who were concerned about excessive Pentagon spending and the nuclear arms race, and were concerned about our path forward in Vietnam. And so they saw from their own service that it's important for the public to be engaged in holding the Pentagon accountable.
Mm-hmm. Well, so why don't we start now in your article? This article was in, I saw it on Portside, and they took it. Was it in the Nation magazine?
It's in the Nation and originally published on Tom Dispatch.
Right. Okay. And it's called "Creating a National Insecurity State: Spending More, Seeing Less." So, why don't we jump right into that? So let me start with the base budget, which the number there is $636 billion.
Yes. So that is what most people would think of as just being the Pentagon's budget. So everything from paying for personnel to new ships, the new planes, military housing, the full gamut of things, the operations and maintenance for all of those things. And typically, out of the base budget, you've seen paying for wars. But under the Budget Control Act, we have the Pentagon using a slush fund called the Overseas Contingency Operations Account.
Mm-hmm.
So that comes in at $69 billion. And, you know, all of these numbers are kind of hard to fathom for mm-hmm. normal people, hard to fathom for me. But to put that into perspective, that would make the Overseas Contingency Operations Account the fourth largest agency.
What kind of contingencies are they talking about?
So the war in Afghanistan, what we're doing in Syria, but when you actually look at what's in that account, a lot of it is for things that should be in the base budget. So the Pentagon admits, you know, $16 billion of this actually really should just be in the base budget. Then they've come up with some of these other kind of ways to move the money around, where they say that, you know, about $33 billion of this is for enduring requirements for refurbishing equipment that we've used in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of cases, we're using this for just maintaining the stuff that we have.
Well, so now our base budget has increased to $716 billion. So now we got this nuclear budget just from the Department of Energy. Now, how does that work? The Pentagon is getting money from the Department of Energy?
So most people think that nuclear weapons spending is done at the Pentagon, but actually a lot of it is at the Department of Energy, that there are a series of labs that run these programs and build these things. And actually what we've been learning in hearings is that that agency actually has $8 billion left over from last year that they haven't even spent.
Really?
And yeah.
What happens to it? I'd always heard, been told that that government agencies, they don't want to have any money left over because then next year their budget may be decreased or something. Is that true?
That is typically the bureaucratic behavior, that you want to use it because otherwise you're going to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's looking like for nuclear spending that they don't have any fear of that kind of accountability occurring. And so they've actually requested 20% more. And you have the Government Accountability Office, which is Congress's watchdog, saying, we're not sure they can even spend all of this money that they're asking for. And so I think that might be one of many areas that could be ripe for Congress to cut without having any concerns that they're going to be jeopardizing our security. And really, it's important to keep in mind as well that these labs have a terrible track record of managing programs, that they have, you know, over the past 5 years or so been $28 billion over budget. Almost everything is delivered years and years behind schedule. So it's kind of the last agency that you should be increasing the budget for.
So the Department of Energy is partly funding the Pentagon. Now this base budget has gone up to $743 billion. And then you got defense-related items that includes the FBI and the CIA.
Yes. And that comes in at a paltry $9.7 billion.
Mm-hmm. Cheap at half the price, yes. Okay.
Yes. But yeah, so things like payments to the CIA retirement fund, different international FBI activities. So again, you know, it's kind of artificial to say just what is the Pentagon. We're looking at a lot of spending that we have for national security.
Then there was one item that kind of mystified me. Is our black budget for intelligence, which is $85 billion. But somehow it lowered our it left the total budget unchanged.
Yes. So, and this comes up every time we do this analysis. It is confusing. So a lot of intelligence spending is actually in different accounts in the Pentagon's budget. So it wouldn't be accurate to count that as additional spending. It's in those accounts. But what we do know is that this year they requested $23.1 billion for military intelligence programs and about $62 billion for other agencies, so the CIA, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. You know, my dad used to be an accountant. And boy. Anyway, so now we have, then you have a retirement and health budget, but that actually lowers our total thing, which seems a little odd to me.
I know. It decreases it by about $8 billion.
Mm-hmm,
so in
yeah.
some cases where we've just kind of overpaid into some of those funds.
Mm-hmm. So now we're at $745 billion, but now we got a big item, Veterans Affairs. Well, when you have a lot of wars, you have a lot of veterans, and they have to be taken care of because they come out of those wars in pretty bad shape if they come out at all. So that is that one item is $238 billion. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so as in the Brown University's Cost of War Project has estimated that the costs of our post 9/11 wars are going to come ultimately to $6.4 trillion. So that $239 billion we're talking about, the VA, it's just part of an initial down payment on those wars and, of course, paying for our veterans who've come home from Vietnam and other wars as well. So it's not just the costs of going to war, but coming home as well.
Mm-hmm. So now we're up to $984 billion, and then we have this international affairs item, and that includes the State Department and USAID, which I've always heard is kind of like a version of the CIA.
Oh, that's interesting. I think it all depends on who you talk to as to whether they consider that to be a effective aid agency or if they consider it to be as you are describing it. But yeah, so they have requested $51.1 billion, and the budget that was submitted by the Trump administration would keep it at that level for the next 5 years. Meanwhile, they would be increasing Pentagon spending and a number of these other accounts over the same period of time. And, you know, there has been a lot of concern that this budget might actually be too low and that you have senior military officers saying that it's important to make sure that we adequately fund diplomacy to be able to prevent these wars.
Well, diplomacy, what are the, that could, you know, a lot of things can be called diplomacy that seem to me are a form of coercion, but why don't we talk, what does this international affairs budget include? Some of the items, maybe.
Oh, sure. So that's really what you're thinking about with the State Department. So the diplomats that we send around the world, our embassies, the different aid projects that we're doing, to try and use, you know, soft power to influence in the world.
So with that, that actually we cracked the $1 trillion mark. That brings us up to $1,035 billion, which is actually another way of saying $1 trillion. And then you've got the Homeland Security budget.
Right. Our Department of Defense does not apparently defend the homeland. The Homeland Security budget includes everything from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to the Transportation Security Administration looking through your luggage at the airport, Secret Service, and Custom and Border Protection, and the Coast Guard. And this year, they requested $52.1 billion.
Well, I guess they have to defend all those military bases, 800 military bases scattered around the world.
Yes, and obviously, you know, I'm sure you've been following the news as well. We've seen that the Department of Homeland Security has also been taking money from the Pentagon's budget to fund the wall that Congress will not approve. So,
well, can you tell us a little bit about that? That's kind of amazing.
It is amazing, and it's really coming into stark relief with the budget debates happening on Capitol Hill that you hear a lot of people saying that the Pentagon can't afford to lose a single dollar, but repeatedly we've seen the Pentagon's budget used as a slush fund for this border when Congress has not approved the funding, when, you know, most constitutional experts believe that this is an unconstitutional act and an abuse of the National Emergencies Act to try and use the authority under that law to be able to get money for the border wall. And it's making it very difficult because you have both the Secretary of Defense saying that funding for the wall is a higher priority than modernization and buying new weapon systems, which I can't be making the defense contractors very happy to hear him saying that. You have our top military officer saying, well, really a couple billion dollars is just a rounding error for the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. And now you're kind of understanding better, oh, this agency can't pass an audit.
Yeah, I like to get into that a little bit later. Finally, we have the last item is interest on our debt, and that is $123 billion. And that brings the total Pentagon budget up to $1.2 trillion. So we have busted the $1 trillion mark. So tell us about this interest on the debt. I mean, that's always there, I guess, isn't it?
It is. You know, it's important to remember that when we spend this money, that there are going to be costs later for it, that we still have a growing deficit. And so this is calculating, okay, what is the national security budget share of this debt? And that comes to $124 billion.
And that goes to actually the money that gets paid to the banks that lend us this money.
Right.
Oh, boy. Well, what you know, we've been hearing a lot over the years about this Pentagon has never been audited. Have they finally been audited?
They have tried to audit the Pentagon several times, but they have yet to pass an audit. One of the reasons for that is they have IT systems that don't talk to each other. And as a consequence, you're not able to settle some of these accounts. Bloomberg News actually reported that last year there were $35 trillion worth of transactions at the Department of Defense that they weren't able to account for. So your father, the accountant, you know, would...
I think he'd tear what hair he's got.
It's, you know, unimaginable. That, and, you know, not something that we would accept from any other federal agency. And given the mission of the Department of Defense, I think it becomes that much more important for them to be accountable to the public. They receive so much money, and they need to demonstrate that they're being responsible stewards of that money.
Well, most federal agencies do have to pass an audit, but has it... So apparently the Pentagon, they never really started an audit? They never got anywhere or what?
So they have attempted to audit the Pentagon for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and they have not been able to pass an audit. So they haven't been able to get a clean opinion. There are certain parts of the department that are able to, but the whole agency has not been able to.
Wow. Well, why don't we talk, you know... So here's the biggest item that we taxpayers have to pay for, and they can't pass an audit. This is amazing. This should be something shouted from the rooftops already. And then there's, you know, things like this. The F-35 fighter plane, most expensive ever, and apparently it doesn't really work.
Right. We still see that the gun doesn't work, that right now they are in the process of wrapping up testing to see if it's going to be effective in combat. Never mind that we've bought hundreds of these and we aren't sure yet if it's effective in combat. So this is the kind of management practices that we see occurring at the Department of Defense, that we just throw money at the problem and we'll, you know, maybe we'll fix the problems later down the line, and it's not producing the kind of results that we should expect. You know, this program has busted its budget estimates multiple times. It's many years behind schedule, so it's kind of the perfect example of how the Pentagon mismanages our money.
So we have this plane, it's got all these bells and whistles on it, and it's most expensive warplane yet. And we don't know if it hasn't passed an audit. We don't really know if it works or not, but we buy them anyway.
We do, and then we've even had a recent audit report saying that, we're not actually sure where all the property is that we've paid for in this program. So uncertainty about some of the spare parts. And it can seem kind of piddly to look at spare part issues, but you have to keep in mind that every weapon system is just... spare parts flying or sailing in formation. So these little things add up.
Mm-hmm. Well, what does the Pentagon get as spare parts? I mean, it's not like you go to the hardware store and buy stuff off the shelf. Don't they have specially made spare parts?
In most cases, they do have specially made spare parts. But actually, one of the things that we have seen contractors successfully do is change the definitions of around the idea of commercial to be able to reduce oversight for that kind of spending. So typically, if something was a commercial part, so you know buy it at the hardware store, you would have a market that's setting a fair and reasonable price. When it's custom made like this, and the United States government is the only customer, you don't have that market pressure. So contracting officers understandably want to get a little bit more information about cost and pricing to make sure that we're paying a fair price. But over time, we've seen different hurdles added so that they aren't able to challenge these kinds of overcharges. So we've seen markups of prices suddenly going up, you know, double, even like 4,000% in just a few years, and with the department having very little recourse to challenge those overcharges.
Oh, wow. Well, So here we have a Pentagon budget, which is over $1 trillion now, and people like President Trump keep boasting that we have the most powerful military machine ever, but still we never seem to be winning any wars. Why is that?
That's a good question. So I think for a lot of these wars, it's not been clear what our goals are. I think that we've too often seen Congress asleep at the wheel, that they've allowed the executive branch to take initial authorizations and stretch them completely out of shape so that we seem to be fighting everywhere in these endless wars and no clear understanding of what does success look like, when can we bring people home. And so I think those have been some of the factors that if you don't hold the Pentagon accountable, if you don't hold senior military leaders accountable, that you continue to have these endless wars.
Well, would Afghanistan be a good example of that?
I think Afghanistan is an excellent example of that. And we're even seeing now with the announcement of a peace agreement, a number of people pushing back and talking about how we need to maintain our presence, that it's not clear what we're going to achieve by doing so. The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction has issued many reports showing all of the ways that our spending there is not sustainable and it's not achieving our goals. And obviously the Washington Post Afghanistan report investigation shows that senior leaders knew that we weren't achieving what we needed to there and that there really was no hope of success. And yet we still threw our men and women in uniform and so much money into this war.
Well, I'm not sure just what they consider success. I think even under Trump's plan, we're supposedly pulling our troops out. There's still a whole bunch of troops left for one reason or another.
Yeah, it's looking that way, and I know that there are also concerns that there isn't enough transparency around this peace agreement too, that Congress is not going to be able to debate this issue as robustly as they should, and that the American people are being left in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, some reporters, like Pepe Escobar, who writes for Asia Times, you know, he says that basically the military is kind of, in a way, they're getting out of Afghanistan because they want to focus on China, and that Afghanistan is kind of like a springboard to maybe operations in Central Asia. Can you comment on that at all?
That is something I've heard as well. One of the things to be wary of, though, I think when we're talking about competition with China and Russia, is that you see a lot of emphasis on weapon systems and really kind of like whiz-bang technology that's pretty expensive, pretty fragile, and pretty unlikely to ever be used, because if we're going into, you know, a war with China or Russia, it seems unlikely that it would be conventional military war that you would think of, that we've seen that there's much more of an emphasis on cyber, that we need to have much more emphasis on how to make sure that we have our economic strength continues as well. And so you see a number of people arguing that some of the ways that we should be shifting these priorities is more investment in combating climate change, more investment in infrastructure, which can help the whole economy. But I, as far as your question as to, you know, this can be a basing for more activity in Central Asia, I think there are a number of people who see it as valuable for us to continue to have a presence there to be able to maintain the ability to wage war wherever we want.
Well, you mentioned, you know, all the, you know, weapon systems with all the bells and whistles, and I guess that's one of the problems with this F-35 is that they kind of load it down with all kinds of little extra things for it to do? So I gave it a whole lot of different tasks, as it were?
Absolutely. So you saw the Marine Corps wanting to have its own engine. You have stealth technology, which is pretty fragile. And you had all, and you know, wanting to make sure that it can launch off of a carrier for the Navy. And so you saw kind of a trying to be a jack of all trades but a master of none.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard that, you know, that the comparison would be with Russian weapons, that they're pretty basic. You know, they're designed to do a specific thing, and they do that pretty well, and they don't try to do too many things at one time. Is that true?
I think that has largely been what we've seen of Russian weapon systems. And even in some of our own weapon systems, we've seen, for example, the A-10 was designed for close air support, so to provide protection for troops on the ground. But in really designing it well for that mission, it's been able to be effective at other missions well. So there's certainly, in other sectors, we've recognized that there's a real virtue to simplicity in design, particularly for resiliency, for things being pretty easy to fix, and continuing to field weapon systems that are so complex and fragile doesn't seem to be practical, to say the least.
Well, you know, it could be that maybe our military is geared for these, I don't know what, but we don't seem to do counterinsurgency very well. You know, we seem to be very good at, bombing other places into dust, and you can't, you know, that can't go on, really. But when it comes to counterinsurgency, we seem to keep looking for an answer. We haven't found it.
Yeah, that does seem to be the pattern. So I think that the public, you know, the next time, unfortunately, I think there will always be a next time that we're going to have debates about these kinds of interventions. So we need to look back on our history to see if a military-first strategy is really going to be what makes us safest. Mm-hmm. And I think what's also particularly concerning is that we're not learning the lessons that we have from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That, you know, for a long time, the Army had actually done its own study of the Iraq War and lessons learned. And for a long time, Army leadership didn't want to let that study see the light of day. And similarly, it's only been with the Afghanistan report that we're starting to see some lessons learned and the work of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan reconstruction. But you don't really see hearings being held, and it doesn't seem to be informing future strategy. Again, as you've mentioned, we're just kind of hyping the China and Russia threats, and that's really just designed to pay for these gigantic weapon systems, and that really the people who profit are the contractors, not the American people.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I see these pictures of our troops on patrol in Afghanistan, you know, and here they are, they're loaded down with all this gear, you know, hanging from their belts and everything, and they're fighting guys with few weapons and wearing sandals. It just seems, but they don't seem to be gaining anything either.
No, and you have the same example, you know, very expensive bombs being dropped on very cheap trucks.
Wow. Uh-huh. Well,
Go ahead. Oh, sorry. No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, you know, we're getting near the end of the show anyway. And the bottom line is that here is over $1 trillion every year gets spent on, wasted on a whole lot of different things, where all these humane things that the government does are starving for funds. Every day you read in the papers that schools or roads or one thing or another are kind of failing because they don't have the money, and here's this big, huge pot of money at the Pentagon.
No, agreed. I think it's important for the public to pay attention, and if they think that we're spending too much at the Pentagon, to contact their lawmakers, and, you know, please come to our website, pogo.org, to learn more.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You've been talking with Mandy Smithberger from POGO and the Center for Defense Information about this kind of bloated budget from the Pentagon. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, stay tuned for KBOO. This is your radio station. Stay tuned.
This is KBOO Portland. Time is 10 o'clock. Coming up next on Flashpoints, it's yesterday's live broadcast from Sonoma State University.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Arnica String Quartet and Peter Zisa on Saturday, March 7th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. The Arnica String Quartet, joined by Peter Zisa, brings you a celebration of Beethoven and the triumph of the human spirit through adversity and isolation. Again, that's the Arnica String Quartet and Peter Zisa, on Saturday, March 7th, from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month's screening is Honeyland, on Thursday, March 12th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Honeyland chronicles a Macedonian woman's journey and strife while cultivating honey using ancient beekeeping traditions. Again, that's Honeyland, on Thursday, March 12th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland.